Last Wednesday, the headlines of the Democrat and Chronicle read, New York gives farm workers a 40-hour work week. Farm workers will soon get overtime pay like everybody else, and this follows some recent achievements for farm workers like the right to collective bargaining, the right to form labor unions, the right to have a day off. I would like to draw attention to the wording of the headlines. New York gives farm workers a 40-hour work week. The accurate way to say it is farm workers win a 40-hour work week. They achieve it. Nobody gave it to them. They won it. They achieved it with hard work for the last 20 years. About 40 of us from the church have been marching with them on the Labor Day parade. And we've watched them lobby lawmakers. We've watched them stand up for themselves. We saw how hard they have struggled and fought for their rights. You know, the same thing would be like saying Congress passed the 19th Amendment and gave women the right to vote. The women won the right to vote. Susan B. Anthony and other women campaigned and agitated for this for decades and decades. In 1872, just down the road here, Susan B. Anthony and 14 other women voted illegally, and our church named our 1872 cafe to honor them. 15 years later, in 1887, women first introduced the voting amendment to Congress. The Senate voted that down 34 to 16. 25 senators didn't even bother to show up for the vote. But that did not deter these women. They assembled in Washington, D.C. every year for 33 years in a row to keep on introducing that legislation. Susan B. Anthony went to the White House to personally lobby President Cleveland, President Arthur, President Garfield, and President Roosevelt. Despite opposition from the Roman Catholic Church, the liquor lobby, and even women themselves, the women finally got it passed in 1920, well after Susan B. Anthony's death. Nobody gave it to them. They won it. Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a struggle. It never did, and it never will. Dr. King said, freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. So this brings us to the story of the widow and the unjust judge. It's a story of David and Goliath, a powerful male judge and an impoverished female widow. Widows, of course, in those days were alone and helpless. Nobody supported them, nobody backed them up. They represented all the victims of injustice and violence and poverty and inequality. But today we have a story of persistence and resistance. It's a story of the widow getting justice, not because the judge gave it to her, but because she demanded it and achieved it. Alan Bosack was a black leader in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. He worked along with Nelson Mandela to dismantle racism. Bosack told a story about his own mother, who was a role model for him. She was a poor black widow, a seamstress who made $1.50 a day, but this woman saved and saved and saved her money, and she bought 400 bricks to build a new house for her family. So one day a white guy delivered the bricks, and he dropped off 250 bricks. She said, I paid for 400. Sorry, lady, that's all you're getting. And she said, okay, all right. But I just want you to know that I believe in a God who takes care of widows like me, and someday you'll know what that means. 2 weeks later, the same guy shows up. He delivers the rest of the bricks. She said, what happened? I don't know. He said, I was building two houses in the last couple weeks, and both of the houses burned to the ground. He said, I thought maybe your God was trying to get my attention. Well, I know another widow, a modern-day widow, who has that same kind of faith and strength. She's sitting right in front of me, Reverend Myra Brown, and she can stand up to the mayor, to the chief of police. She can stand up to city council, to a whole row of law enforcement officers during the Daniel Prude marches. She can stand up to the county legislature to advocate for black voting districts. She can stand up to the church when it curtails people's rights. She can stand up to the social service department when it tries to cut corners on people's benefits because she believes that God is on the side of justice. And that's the kind of widow we hear about today in the story, facing the unjust judge. Now, this judge is no match for this determined woman. Her persistence is rooted in a clarity of purpose. She knows what she's about. She's focused on her agenda, achieving justice. In the 1960s, a lot of us remember there were sit-ins at lunch counters in the South. The purpose was to desegregate restaurants and institutions. There's a student there, Diane Nash. She was 20 years old, she was an activist, and she was part of the student wing of the civil rights movement. Diane organized a successful student sit-in at a lunch counter in Nashville, Tennessee. The reporters asked her, "Why did you put yourself in such great danger?" And she replied, "We are people who are no longer willing to live with segregation." Notice how focused that was, how clear. We are people who are no longer willing to live with segregation. Despite getting cursed, getting hot coffee thrown at her, ketchup squirted at her, despite even the possibility of getting killed, she was clear, we are people who are no longer willing to live with segregation. I wonder what we are no longer willing to live with. Susan B. Anthony was another person who was pretty focused. Now, in a few days, I'm going to become 75 years old, and I remember that Susan B. Anthony was interviewed on her 75th birthday here in Rochester. And she said during that birthday interview, "I have given my whole life to getting women the right to vote. It's all I live for." What focus? It's all I live for. So the judge in this parable is a narcissist. Jesus says he doesn't fear God, and he has no respect for any human being. He has no religion, and he has no conscience. He has no business holding that office. So what does the widow do for strategy? Does she appeal to the judge's good side? No. Why not? Because he doesn't have one. He doesn't have a good side. Does she flatter him? No. Does she buy him off? She doesn't have any money. Her only weapon is to stand her ground and refuse to go away, to be in his face, to bother him, to wear him down. She refuses to participate in her own oppression. She proclaims her dignity as a human being. I am worth it. I deserve it. I might not be valuable in your eyes, but I am very valuable in the eyes of God. She is a one-woman justice machine. She advocates for herself before a narcissistic judge and a seemingly uncaring world. The poet Tagore said, "If no one will walk with you, then walk alone. Walk alone." This is threatening to the judge, which somehow creates a relationship. Now remember, he has no relationships, not with God, not with human beings, but she forces him to interact because she's gotten to him. The judge acts in order to protect himself, which might not be a bad thing. Each does what will benefit themselves, and both eventually get what they want. She gets justice, and he gets rid of her. This widow refuses to participate in her own oppression. She's a role model for the women today in Iran. The women in Iran are shaking the streets. They're boldly chanting, "Women, life, and liberty! Women, life, and liberty!" These protests, as you know, started with women burning their headscarves, but the protests have widened across lines of gender, race, age, and class. And Iranians all over are demanding an end to the repression. We see that same spirit of resistance and persistence in Ukraine. President Putin has targeted cultural buildings and cultural monuments to bomb. He's trying to demoralize the Ukrainians, trying to erase their identity. But the Ukrainians have fought back. They play music in bombed-out theaters. They continue to dance and to act in ruined concert halls. They continue to cover up their monuments with sandbags because they know that Putin has a military superiority force, but they have something more important than he does. They have moral power, just like this widow does. And they're not giving up, no matter how hard it is. They're doing what the letter of Timothy says today: be persistent, whether convenient or inconvenient. Be persistent. What is helping these protests in Iran and Ukraine is a sense of community. They have popular support, the support of the people, inside and outside the country. In order to sustain our pursuit of justice, we need each other too. We need community. In the first reading, when Moses' spirit was getting weary, his friends Aaron and Hur come to help. They hold up his arms. They lifted his spirit. And we need community too, to hold each other up, to keep our struggles alive, to lift our spirits during hard times. People in recovery know how important community is. They have the 12-step community. A recovering alcoholic explained why he goes regularly to AA meetings. He said, "If I don't go regularly, I will start drinking again." And it's funny, the meetings are so predictable. The same things are said over and over again. I know what they're going to say even before I go to a meeting. But he said, "I don't go to be a nice person. I go there to stay alive. If I don't go, I will destroy myself." And the same thing might be said about us, why we come to church. Like, why do you come to church? Isn't it so that we don't fall apart? So we don't become full of ourselves, or depressed, or selfish, or angry at the world, or cynical? Now, the rituals are always the same. They're predictable. We know what's going to be said over and over every Sunday. The same things, over and over. The rituals in the community bring us healing and wholeness. They allow God to do in us what we can't do for ourselves. Christianity is always about community, always about community. Some of us remember Pope John XXIII. When he was first elected Pope, he was walking through the Vatican, and he noticed a telephone repairman who was overhauling the telephone system in the Vatican. The Pope says, "How's it going?" "Lousy. With the wages you're paying, lousy." A priest was walking with the Pope. He said, "That's no way to talk to the Pope." He said, "I don't care. He's paying me stupid wages. I can't afford to feed my family." So the next day, the Pope saw the same repairman. He said, "How's it going?" "I told you, lousy. You're paying me dirt wages." And this was starting to draw crowds. Other workers in the Vatican gathered around, and they said, "Yeah, you're not paying us anywhere's what we need either. We could hardly feed our families. There hasn't been a raise in years." So he says, "Well, tell me about this." So he gathered the people, and they started telling how terrible these wages are. So a few weeks later, Pope John increased all the Vatican salaries by 40%. Of course, he ran into trouble with the Vatican finance guys. They said, "Well, we can't do that. We have to take money away from stuff we set aside for charity if we do that." He said, "We'll take it out of charity." He said, "This raise is overdue, and this is justice, and justice comes before charity." Doing justice means holding your ground, sometimes getting in people's faces, being loud, being disruptive, being focused, being persistent. Don't expect the powerful to give anything. You gotta win it. Power concedes nothing without a struggle. And the struggle is often messy. The German poet Goethe said, "When you go out to fight for justice, don't wear your best clothes.